There is only one consciousness. And the closer you get to that consciousness, the more you realize that in its purity, and you realize that everything else is from this source consciousness. When I finally put the disbelief aside and let the rational mind take a backseat to the intuitive mind, it started opening up a whole series of things, clairvoyance, clairaudience, remote viewing, premonitions, and so forth. So I was like really tapping into another dimension. In fact, many of the books that I wrote were more or less channeled books.
Right, welcome to the New Age Human Podcast. I'm your host, John Astacio, and welcome to another mind-bending episode. Insert explosion. In this episode, we're talking with Peter Canova, who is an award-winning author and philosopher. He's the author of the 25-time award-winning First Souls Trilogy and has contributed to the popular Chicken Soup for the Soul series. Now, if you're interested in diving into quantum spirituality, archons, levels of consciousness, spiritual abilities with examples, and more, you're going to like this episode. But more importantly, stick around to the very end because we do dive into Gnostic wisdom and the origin of what's called the first souls. Now, before we get started, as a reminder, we're looking for your feedback. I want to know what's working, what's not working. Let me know. Or if you have someone that you're very interested in me talking with, I definitely want to hear about that. All the links to contact me and even join our community are in the links below. With that said, buckle up. You're in for a ride. Thank you for coming today. Let's get to the show. All right, Peter Canova, thank you for coming on to the show. How's it going, man?
Good. Good to be with you today.
I'm noticing everybody has some really cool paintings, and I always encourage everybody to go to YouTube. You have a really interesting painting behind you. You have some swords. You have a scene going on. It's very interesting.
That actually is kind of an Atlantis-like theme, which relates to one of the books in the trilogy that I wrote. So I kind of gravitated towards that when I saw it.
Oh, man, right? Like a picture's worth a thousand words, and I feel like every funky picture has like a story behind it. So, I mean, you're the guy who writes the books, man. We're definitely going to go into quantum spirituality. I definitely want to go into that because that's going to be a very interesting and deep subject. And if anybody knows, we like those deep subjects. But first, I want to get an idea of where you're coming from. Could you give us an idea of what your own spiritual waking, your own spiritual awakening was like?
Yeah, sure. Well, look, actually, I'm an international businessman, and when I was in my 20s, I had a very vivid series of experiences, and I found out that I was a very accurate medical intuitive. And when I finally put the disbelief aside and let the rational mind take a backseat to the intuitive mind, it started opening up a whole series of things, clairvoyance, clairaudience, remote viewing, premonitions, and so forth. So I was like really tapping into another dimension. In fact, many of the books that I wrote were really more or less channeled books. One of the first books I wrote from a trilogy called the First Souls Trilogy, called Pope Annalisa, about an African nun that comes to the Pope during a time when America and Iran are going into a nuclear war. There was an article that was written in Own Times magazine about all the geopolitical predictions in the book that came to pass. And so sometimes I felt, honestly, like, did I really write this? I felt like it was, you know, somebody else was writing it. But what it really turned me on to was I realized that there are other dimensions of existence out there. And those other dimensions really relate more to consciousness than anything else. I mean, are they physical places? In some instances, they may be. But really, for me, it was more like I was tapping in to, you know, a higher dimensional consciousness. So when we talk about things like parallel dimensions or alternate universes or the multiverse, to me, that's a very real thing, not an abstract, because my consciousness has kind of dipped into those places.
So interesting how you brought that up, that you made the logic side of your mind take a back seat and you started working with your intuitive mind. What kicked that off? Because it's not the easiest thing to do. That's your ego. You're saying, hey, take a back seat. And it sounded like once you did that, you projected into a different world of possibilities and clairs. Could you break down how did you make that happen?
Well, I didn't make it happen. It just happened. In other words, I had the experiences. And what I did was I didn't allow my rational mind to kill the experiences. See, because I really believe that everybody can tap into these things. And so many times we have valuable intuition, but we dismiss it almost in the same instant that it arises because we're not used to thinking like that. You know what I'm saying? So in my case, I just didn't let that happen. I just said, okay, let the experience go. I mean, yeah, it surprised me. I had no antecedents to this, but I just said, you know, let it go. And I'm a Capricorn. So
me too.
It's funny. Okay. So it wasn't that easy for me in a way, but I did it. But here's the funny thing. It all circled back around. Because after I was completely immersed in these experiences, and I mean, literally at times I felt like I was living in an alternate universe for a large part of my life, let my rational mind come back into the picture. And I said, you know what? I don't want to just have these experiences. I want to understand the nuts and the bolts behind them. I started studying ancient spiritual traditions, and that eventually led me on to quantum physics, because the nexus there is that both disciplines deal with light, energy, and matter. Those are really the crux of the three things that ancient spirituality and quantum physics looks at, because light is the basis of the universe. Without light energy, we would have no perceptible universe. We wouldn't, I don't know what we'd be, but we wouldn't be what we think we are. So, then I started more like a formal study, kind of a intellectual, scholarly, academic study of those things so that I could understand from a multidisciplinary point of view. And I looked at Jungian psychology and neurophysiology, and all this is incorporated in my new book, Quantum Spirituality, which essentially is all about having extraordinary experiences with higher consciousness. Mm-hmm. And I kind of set an arena for my readers to do that through this multidisciplinary approach. So, you know, when I used to go to a lot of these conferences, these sort of spiritually oriented conferences, and I mean, they were great, but I often found that, you know, you'd sort of just have to take on faith what they were saying. And they were, you know, it was what I called a unidimensional approach. They were just talking from a spiritual standpoint. So I said, you know, if I'm going to do a roadmap for people so that they may have the possibility of having similar experiences to what I have, you need more than one coordinate, right? If a map takes north and south, latitude and longitude, and, you know, my coordinates were science, quantum science, and ancient spiritual tradition, but also things like Jungian psychology and so forth. So I took this multidisciplinary approach to show that all these separate lines of inquiry were really pointing towards the same things. And I think that's where the value that most of the readers are getting out of my book, Quantum Spirituality, which is putting all these dots together. And some people may say, oh, you know what? I kind of knew that, but I didn't know it. I didn't know all these other things about it, you know? And so connecting those dots, I think, is where the real value lies in the body of work that I'm doing.
So you're talking about, we're getting into quantum spirituality and those experiences. Can you highlight some of those experiences that you had that made you say, you know what, let's go into this? Because I have some questions. I want to put some dots together. I want to do some research. Sure.
Well, the first thing was finding out that I was an accurate medical intuitive, and I was in a course sort of where they were teaching people ESP, extrasensory perception, which is a term we don't use as much today, but back then it was kind of in vogue, and they would have us pair off and go in a corner, and you'd be sitting in a chair opposite another person, and that person would have an index card, and on the index card there would be information about an individual that was having either a psychological or, for the most part, physical problem. And the very first case that I did was an elderly gentleman down in Miami, and all they were allowed to do was tell me the name, age, and address of the person. They can't give you anything more because they don't want to lead you with information. So they said, what can you tell me about this person? And I had a picture of his heart tilted at a funny angle, which was causing the aorta to be pinched off. And I said, he seems to have a blockage in his aorta. And they said, that's correct. What else can you tell us? And I saw something down in the bottom left quadrant of his heart that just didn't seem normal. It seemed artificial, kind of metallic. And I said, I think he had a pacemaker installed. And they said, that's correct. Can you tell us what year the pacemaker was installed? So I saw the hands of a clock moving wildly, and then they stopped dead at 10 o'clock, which to me indicated 10 years prior. And I said, yes, it was, and I gave them the date, and they said, yes, that's accurate. So, from that point on, I was just diagnosing a lot of medical cases. I had a girlfriend at the time that worked at the VA hospital. She used to bring me cases from the hospital that I used to do and give back to the doctors. And, you know, and then I was living in this working class neighborhood in Boston. I had people lining up outside my door because I became like, you know, sort of like the voodoo medicine man of the neighborhood. And, after a while, I gave that up because honestly, almost anybody who's a medical intuitive burns out on it after a while. And So I don't really do that anymore. But like I say, that the fact that I now understood that there's other dimensions of existence over there and my mind was open to that, I started having all these other experiences of clairvoyance, clairaudience, remote viewing and premonitions and things like that, even to the point where, you know, I had premonitions that saved my life and other people's lives. Once you have all those things, you sort of own that world. You know, to a lot of people listening to me today, this may sound abstract, it may sound intellectual, whatever the case may be, and they may think in theory, yeah, I believe in these things, but there's a difference between believing something on faith that you haven't experienced and actually experiencing it. So I can tell you, for instance, that fire burns, but until you stick your hand in the fire, you don't know that for a fact. Once you stick your hand in the fire, you own it, okay? Once you have a direct experience with these things, you own it, and it becomes part of your reality. It becomes part of your base of reality. And it's very transformative when that happens, when you break out of that bubble of the perceptual material world to understand that there's other dimensions of information out there. It becomes very transformative. So I wanted to help people, you know, get to that point too, so that they wouldn't have to even take my information on faith. And in fact, a lot of times when I speak nationally, I start off by saying to the audience, don't believe a damn thing I'm going to tell you. And they sit there scratching their heads and saying, well, what did I pay to come to this thing for? But, right. You know, what I really mean by that is that, you know, listen to what I say, think about it, take it provisionally, and then test it out, you know, with your own spiritual practice, whether that's meditation or whatever your spiritual practice is. Take this arena of information that I'm trying to immerse you in and use it to help propel your own journey to the point where you have these experiences directly, because that's the goal. The goal is having direct experience, not book knowledge, not taking it on faith for somebody else, but having direct experience with higher consciousness.
There's two people that your language and what your story is reminding me of. One, the medical medium. Are you familiar with him?
I'm not.
In a similar way, and I can feel by your energy, there's a lot. You have a lot of energy. You have a lot of power behind you, a lot of potency. The medical medium did similar things where he was connected with something called the spirit of compassion. I think it's like a being of sort that helped him diagnose people's illnesses. And I think you'd appreciate his works because you have your experience as well, doing something very similar where someone asks him a question and you have doctors coming asking you questions because they're stumped. But you can see it in your mind's eye, you sense it, and it's very specific, like that example you just described. The other person, Edgar Cayce.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Very familiar with Edgar Cayce, yeah.
And he popped up because you said you got drained, because just a lot of demand. Before we go further, any advice that you give to anybody that has any of the clairs, right, any of the sensitivities, whether you have multiple or whatever, and you start to turn that into some sort of practice, because let's say you felt called to do so, any advice for them to prevent burnout?
Well, you know, Edgar Cayce was very interesting because he is very opposite of what I did. Edgar Cayce was in a sleep trance when he did his readings. My mind were always very conscious. It's tough because you can sort of, you know, surround yourself with, you know, a protective ball of white energy. And I mean, I do think that works. But also when you're doing conscious readings, it's very hard to tell people certain things, and you have to be very careful if they're not aware, because you don't want to, you know, you don't want to pop something on them that's life-changing and devastating. So it becomes very tricky on how you do these things, and it does kind of put an emotional, you know, drain on you to see something in a child or even, you know, an adult, whatever. It does put an emotional drain on you. I mean, my advice is don't do it for a living. do it for as long as your guidance tells you you can do it. And if you start feeling, you know, if you start feeling it's too much, then, you know, ease off. I mean, my own experience wasn't even with medical intuition, but I got to the point where I would know conversations 10 minutes ahead of time. I'd touch somebody and I'd know like a lot about their life history. I was like a psychic sponge and I was out of control and it was really burning me out. And I had to literally run away from it, shut myself down. I went to England, actually, to the British Spiritualist Association to really kind of get some guidance. But after a while, I had to really shut it down and almost forget about it for a while because it was too hard to live in two dimensions. You know, I didn't know where I was. And, you know, I was really kind of, I was probably more like 1 foot in the other world than I was in this for quite some time. And I, you know, so I backed off on it. Now there's a happy medium. I don't have all those impressions that I used to have, but you know what? I don't want them. I don't really care. I really don't want them. What I've really tried to do is help direct people to achieve goals that they want to achieve through this knowledge. And when they get to the point in their meditation where they can sort of set intention to help problem solve. But you know, it's when you tap into this, it's almost just like generally your life improves. I always say, okay, you want to live in the basement or you want to live in the penthouse? So if you live in the basement, you know, you can survive. I mean, you'll have a job, you have a family, you know, you go to the movies, you go to dinner and everything else. That's fine, but that's not all there is to life. If you really want to see the panorama of life and other realities and everything else, you want to move up to the penthouse, and that means an elevation of consciousness, an elevation of your awareness. And it actually can be a good experience. I mean, sometimes people like myself, it gets a little overboard. You have to control it, but don't be afraid. That doesn't happen to everybody, and it doesn't necessarily have to happen to you. You can work better at guiding it than maybe I did, because, you know, remember with me, this kind of really happened spontaneously, and it was I didn't really have the control mechanisms, let's say, initially to cope with all the things that I was going through. But I think the real value of all this that and you know the my body of work, which consists of a trilogy, a spiritual thriller called The First Souls Trilogy, about the first souls to incarnate material experience. I tried to get these principles out in an entertaining way rather than in, you know, sort of like a scholarly kind of way or didactic kind of way. And it did very well. It won like 25 national and international awards, but it really did help a lot of people out. Then I got to the point where I said, well, you know, gee, I have like this 35, almost 40 years of research that went into making the trilogy, which consisted of psychology, quantum physics, and spiritual traditions. And I said, why don't I write something that is more like a self-help or a guidance book? And that's what quantum spirituality is about. So that was my first nonfiction work.
So the trilogy is pretty much taking all your experiences and what you've learned and turning into a fictional piece of work that goes through three different stories, I believe, right?
Yes.
And they teach you through the story that didn't happen, or is it a story that's like partial true, but it's more of the message?
Well, no, I mean, there's definitely historical accuracy in much of the book. The first book, like I said, Pope Annalisa, is about an African nun that becomes the Pope during a time when America and Iran are going into a nuclear war. The second book is called The 13th Disciple, which takes place during biblical times. It has a lot of historical accuracy to it. The first book does have historical accuracy in terms of the inner operations of the Catholic Church and so forth and so on. The third book is what gets into kind of interesting, gets into where you were talking about before with Edgar Cayce, because a lot of it is actually very similar to the Cayce readings. It's the origin of the first souls. And these first souls appear throughout different epochs of history at times when humanity is either going to evolve or sink backwards. So the souls throughout the three books are consistent. They have different manifestations, but their souls are consistent, and it shows their soul growth. So they're not, you know, and so at the very beginning, they're not always the most clued in, you know, people in the world, but, you know, but they evolve like anything else, and they evolve to a recognition of the fact that, you know, they were some of the first souls that led the fall from the perfect realm of spirit into material existence. And it's their burden to help people regain that high spiritual status. So the third book, which it was written Star Wars way in reverse order, the third book is actually the book of origins, the first book. It's called The Light of Distant Suns. And it's about when they first came into Earth and they formed this high civilization, this Atlantis-like civilization, but they ended up destroying themselves in a vicious civil war between those who remembered the where they came from, the higher consciousness, and those who had completely given into materiality and you know, couldn't recognize anymore their higher origins. And but it was interesting because out of that destruction were born the early civilizations of Egypt and Greece. So it's a real tour de force of creation, and what it really describes is the whole story of creation and the purpose of a human being from the standpoint of these ancient spiritual traditions with supporting elements from quantum physics.
And that story comes from all you piecing together a lot of different works, correct?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was channeled, and some of it came from, you know, just my good old grinding research and everything else. But and I mean, like I say, it was a cult hit. In fact, I'm working with an associate of mine who was an ex-executive at HBO, and we're working to get the first book, Pope Annalisa, into a TV series right now.
Well,
so keep
really
our fingers
cool.
crossed. Yeah,
yeah, man, I want to see that. That's I can only imagine the type of recognition and excitement that would bring, because there's a lot of people that have questions that hear this, and you want to put pieces together, and to see it cinematically and, you know, physically being represented, it should be really interesting. Getting into quantum spirituality, we have the divine mind, the karmic memories, the suppressed memories, the metaphysical matrix. My thing is, like you said, it's like more of a self-help book. And I feel something that's really digestible is the three layers that you were talking about as far as your consciousness. Is that what you... like, how do you tie it together? Do you tie everything together with the three levels of consciousness? Because that's how I'm seeing it being done. And then you kind of go into these different avenues. What would be the best way to, I guess, think about that book to approach it and digest it from there, if that makes sense?
Yeah, well, the three levels of consciousness come into play in that one of the major themes of the book is that we all descend from the source consciousness of all creation. We're not separate creations, okay? Judeo-Christianity has done a little bit of a disservice in terms of how they have pictured the creation and a human being. And essentially, the traditional Western religious conception of creation is that there was this judgmental God. You can almost think of him like an old bearded guy in a throne, like throwing thunderbolts around, like Zeus for the ancient Greeks. But, you know, it was a sort of judgmental God that made a separate creation called the human being out of the dust of the earth, breathed life into him. And then, you know, kind of like here we are, like in this lunatic asylum, bouncing around like dolls, not really knowing, you know, what we're doing. But by the same token, under original sin, we ticked God off, and now we're forever trying to get back in his good graces. So the conception of creation and the human being in the traditional religious Western viewpoint is a very lowly one. But what you find is in all the ancient spiritual traditions, from Hindu to Buddhism to, you know, the mystical traditions like the Kabbalah and the Gnostic Christianity, they said, no, that's not the way it is. We are actually extensions, conscious extensions of the one source that created everything, albeit in a diluted form, a lower vibrational form, so that we have kind of forgotten what we really are, but we thought ourselves and dreamed ourselves into this existence. So it's kind of like, if you remember the old Star Trek series where they had a holodeck, And the crew used to go down and they used to, you know, run these simulations, and they were so real that they could actually kind of immerse themselves in the simulation and interrelate with the characters, the artificial characters and everything. Well, that's kind of what really happened with us. We forgot when we were the programmers that we did such a good job of dreaming ourselves into, you know, the consciousness of physicality. And I think that the whole idea of the three levels of mind you were talking about, you know, the conscious, the subconscious, and the unconscious, what that really is, was a mechanism for perpetuating the illusion. Because at higher levels of consciousness, there's one consciousness. There is only one consciousness. And the closer you get to that consciousness, the more you realize that in its purity, and you realize that everything else is, yes, there's a reality to it, but it's a quasi-reality, because it's only a reality that draws its dimensions or its characteristics from this source consciousness. So in a way, I mean, people have asked, I mean, who was the famous philosopher that said, you know, if there is a God, why does he hide himself so well? Well, the answer to that question is found in the book. And the answer to that question is that in order to experience for spirit, which is pure energy, to experience the idea of being in a material form, there has to be illusion involved. We projected ourselves into this kind of virtual reality, and the subdivision of our minds, you know, the unconscious probably contains so many of the answers to what we're talking about here, but the conscious mind doesn't really recognize that or communicate with it, because the conscious mind is the ego mind. It's the one that thinks that we are you, me, in a physical body, when we're what we really are is spirit in visitation of a physical body. So, you know, the whole idea of the three levels of mind really is a mechanism to perpetuate that illusion. And it's all part of spirit wanting to experience individuality. People say, well, you know, if there was this perfect force over there, why would it want to come down to something as miserable as this? There's lots of different ways you can look at that question from many, many different angles. But the answer in the ancient spiritual traditions was that if you were just pure being or pure spirit, you could be, but you really weren't experiencing. It would be a very static existence. So in order to experience, this one force of consciousness projected itself out into more diluted forms of consciousness, more limited forms of consciousness. And it's this limitation that allows other consciousness or other spirits to believe that they are individuals. The price of individuality is limitation, because if you weren't operating out of a consciousness of limitation, you'd be absorbed back into the source itself. You'd just go right back into that one source. So the one source
thing.
The one source needs to kind of trick itself or even fool itself into you know, having these other dimensions of conscious beings, and then those beings in turn, you know, went off in their own exploration, which culminated in spirit falling into physical form, which is what we call a human soul. Soul is different from spirit. Spirit never really left the sphere of the one. It still has a very high consciousness of the one force, and it works in harmony with the one force from which it came. Souls are those spirits that kind of went off on a tangent to explore their own individuality. They broke with the kind of hive mind. They broke with the harmony of the source in order to have their own individual experience. And that's the difference between a soul and a spirit.
So would you say two things? One, would you say the conscious is more of like closer to the ego, the subconscious is closer to the soul that is self-identified as more individual, but still a little bit more connected, and then the unconscious mind is more that mind connected to the universal consciousness, the universal being, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, generally, yeah, but the unconscious itself is kind of interesting, because it both appears to be the source, to embody the higher source of where we came from, but it also, as Carl Jung would say, embodies the shadow. It can embody the sort of unresolved issues or complexes that we accumulate here on Earth. So the unconscious is very turbulent. It's kind of like a little bit of a battleground the subconscious, the utility of the subconscious is that it can recall things that aren't part of the everyday conscious mind. But when the conscious mind needs to call on it, it is in a more ready form, whereas you can't really do that with the unconscious. The unconscious has kind of a play of its own, and it's much harder to get through to the unconscious. But to the extent that we involve ourselves in meditation and higher spiritual practice, we start to get in contact with the positive aspects of the unconscious, where these higher forces or these higher archetypes can play themselves out in our lower, more material existence.
And I'm glad that you brought that in as far as meditation, because from my experience, that's how I would gain communication from the subconscious and then, throw a fishing line so you can somehow get some information from the unconscious and beyond, right? And then you also have that deep part of you and then the part that's way beyond. How do you suggest managing those parts of yourself in a positive way without making yourself vulnerable to maybe a negative archetype that wants to trick you into thinking something else is going on,
Yeah. Well, for one thing, a lot of it has to do with intention. And, I find that when you enter with a good intentions, which means that you want to be of service to other people, or you want to improve yourself to be a better human being, to be of service to other people and yourselves, that sort of gives you a little bit of a cloak, of protection in these things anyway. And it helps you discern, you're getting, perhaps bad information. There is something that's very interesting in the ancient spiritual tradition and almost all the spiritual traditions, which is like this force of opposition. And the force of opposition, to my way of understanding, was right there from the very beginning of the creation. And the reason, the function of the force of opposition is that it allows for individuality. So, for instance, a spirit can either choose to sort of stay in the harmony of the one, in Christian terms, you'd say staying near the throne of God. But, or the other choice would be to, okay, I want to pursue my own track. I want to pursue my own vector or destiny. And those, then you become a soul. You're a spirit in terms of having experience. And the force of opposition, if it wasn't there, if the whole idea of opposition wasn't there, then there would be no thought, there'd be no choice. So the force of opposition is a choice of whether you want to sort of remain in the kind of, like, and I call it hive mind. I probably shouldn't, because that has a somewhat negative connotation. You think of the Borg or something like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, the spiritual sphere, to go off in other realms of exploration. So it's that force of opposition that allows that to happen. Now, as you get into the lower planes of existence, the force of opposition could take on more nasty characteristics and maybe even shade into what, we call evil. Evil is essentially getting to the point where you're so divorced from the idea of your unity with all things that you can be harmful to other things because you're operating off of pure ego. Hitler was an egomaniac, obviously. Joseph Stalin was an egomaniac. Mao Zedong was an egomaniac. I mean, these are people who killed millions of people, and because obviously they didn't really understand the concept of, even at an intellectual level, of the unity of all things. So, and interestingly enough, the whole concept of the devil in Christianity and Judaism, the devil originally was not a cloven-hoofed, horned figure of evil. The devil was the angel of opposition. And it actually performed a good function because the opposition allowed human beings to grow, to overcome that opposition. They would grow in wisdom and strength and, get back nearer to the source from which they came. So, you see that the idea of opposition, I think, was intrinsic in the creation itself. And sort of depending upon the level at which it arises, it can take on the appearance more of being evil. But remember this, it's still a product of our own minds. I really believe that the whole idea of the devil and all these other dark figures that are in spiritual lore are actually products of our own creation, or are actually products of our own shadow or dark side.
I've heard that, and that does align with the observer effect, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're in quantum physics, your observation and belief structure manifests in your reality. And so, yeah, if you have certain belief structures on this thing or that thing, that's going to hurt you. And some people even, how about this? What are your thoughts on, like, the whole Skinwalker Ranch, where you have these different shapeshifter beings, and then you have these creatures that people see? Some people believe that those were created by simply the belief structure of culture that supported it.
Yeah, I'm not quite as familiar. I've heard of the Skinwalker, but in the Gnostic text, they're called Archons. In Carlos Castaneda called them flyers, and they were both these sort of shadowy figures that fed off of negative human emotions and played a negative role. The Archons, for instance, in the Gnostic text, were these quasi psychic beings that seemed to have an individual existence, but really were products of erroneous beliefs and the shadow beliefs of, you know, the spirits or the souls in general. And they were never portrayed really as physical beings that walk this earth, like, you know, possessed devils in the human form, but they did have an effect in the psychic level and could be perceived at a psychic level. And that's why they're often called shadow figures. They're sort of like these shadowy things on the edge of material experience, but not really truly material. They were quasi, you know, quasi kind of psychic beings. But their function really was to sort of keep humanity in bondage, to keep humanity, they feed off of the negative emotions of humanity. And the Archons were the one that, when a soul passed on, the Archons were the ones who were said to cast them back into the earth for reincarnation. They, unless the soul was enlightened enough to pass them as the gatekeepers to go on to ascend to higher realms. So, you know, there has always been this tradition of, you know, these negative or, you know, darker forces. The question is, where do they come from? Do they have an individual existence, or are they really, you know, products of the collective soul psyche? I tend to believe the latter rather than the former.
That kind of reminds me of the hero's journey where they have to fight themselves. I'm forgetting the movie, and I keep referencing movies, but essentially, like, one of the guys is like a wizard, and he's trying to accomplish a certain skill to be able to wield this weapon so he can save his friends. And whenever he touched it, he would go into this other space, and he would have to battle something that he was afraid of.
Yeah.
And in the end, it was actually himself that he had to battle, which is an ongoing theme that I hear, especially with what you're saying and trying to just digest all of this.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of popular manifestations of this. I remember an old movie. I can't remember the name of it, but Leslie Nielsen, the guy who was an airplane, was the main character in the movie. And it was a kind of like outer space movie, and he went to this planet where this scientist and his daughter were being stalked by this invisible creature that would batter down doors and, you know, do all these like nasty things. And at the end of the day, they found out that the creature was actually a manifestation of the scientist's mind, you know, gone awry. And you know, so, I mean, that's just another example in pop culture of what you were just saying.
Yeah.
Of the things that we've been talking about.
I'm actually intrigued by you brought it up, the origin of the Archons, the Gnostic records, you said, or the books. What are those?
Are Archons?
The Gnostic
Gospels. Oh, the Gnostic Gnostic Gospels.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so at the beginnings of the Christian era, it actually predated Christianity. The Gnostics were a group centered in Alexandria, Egypt. And Alexandria was the intellectual capital of the world at that time. The cross currents of philosophical, spiritual, and whatever scientific thought there was of that day, all passed through Alexandria. So we know that there was Hindu influence, Buddhist influence, Zoroastrian, Egyptian Hermetic, Jewish Kabbalah, and even, you know, Greek Hellenistic mysteries were all streams of wisdom that were flowing through Alexandria, and they were kind of embodied and synthesized by a group called the Gnostics. And the Gnostics means those who know. It comes from the Greek word gnosein, which means to know. And they were a group which would have been part of the ancient mystery schools dotted around the world at that time. But when Jesus of Nazareth came along and started his teaching, they instantly recognized his teaching as a Gnostic teaching. So they became amongst the first Christians. Now, what happened was, we know from the Bible itself that Jesus had two teachings. He had a secret inner mystical teaching, and he had an outer teaching. And in all the Synoptic Gospels, it says, plain as day, that unto the masses he spoke in parables, but unto the disciples he gave the keys to the kingdom of heaven. In other words, he revealed the mysteries to them. And that is further validated by the writings of early church fathers like Origen and I'm trying to remember the name of the other Christian bishop of Alexandria at the time. There were two Christian bishops, but Origen was one of them. And I don't know why the name slips me right now. But they both wrote that indeed Jesus had a secret teaching, which he would not impart to the masses because they wouldn't understand it. So he imparted it to the elect meaning those who were intellectually or spiritually advanced enough to really understand it, so that the teachings wouldn't be bastardized. So Clement was the other bishop, Clement of Alexandria and Origen. So anyway, what happened was that two streams of Christianity coexisted in the early days. There was the inner mystical teachings of the Gnostics, and then there was the outer teachings, which evolved eventually into the Orthodox Catholic Church. And that outer church received the imprimatur of Rome as the state religion, and that was the church of the dogma, of the bishops, of the hierarchy, and everything else. Well, they coexisted for some time. Gnostics and Orthodox would, you know, attend the same early gatherings. And incidentally, there was no such thing as Christianity in the early days. That would be a term that would not be recognizable to the early followers of Jesus. They called themselves followers of the Way. Now, the Way indicates a spiritual path, not a religion. And that's indeed what Jesus was teaching. He was teaching a spiritual path, like yoga might be or something. He wasn't, you know, there was no hierarchy. In fact, the early church leaders were pretty much female. Now, the Gnostics had their own gospels that revealed these mysteries, but the Catholic Church suppressed them. And in 1945, Egyptian peasants who were poking around for manure at the mouths of these caves, cliff caves outside of a town called Nag Hammadi in Egypt, found these clay jars, and they broke them open and outspilled all these scrolls. And lo and behold, they were the writings of the original Gnostic masters, which were suppressed. They theorized that there was a nearby Orthodox seminary called St. Pachomius, and that monks from that seminary may have hid them when Bishop Athanasius made a proclamation that, you know, you better not be caught with any Gnostic works, and they're to be burned and everything else. So chances are it was those monks that hid those away. What was cool about this is that for the first time, we were hearing the original mystical Christian teaching through the voice of the Gnostic masters, whereas prior to this, the only way we knew about them was through the writings of their enemies, which were the early church fathers like Hippolytus and Irenaeus, you know, and they wrote about the Gnostics and about their beliefs, but obviously they skewered a lot of things because they hated the Gnostics. So now, all of a sudden, we had these original gospels, which were startlingly different from Orthodox Christianity. You know, they said, number one, you know, we don't need your hierarchy. We're not these little separate creations. We're actually emanations or projections of the one consciousness itself. So we don't, you know, we don't need a hierarchy. Also, the early leadership was decidedly female. So Mary Magdalene in the Gnostic Gospels was pictured as the primary disciple. And Peter, who is the big hero of the Orthodox Catholic Church, was pictured as a dunce. He didn't get it. He couldn't understand the radical teachings of Jesus. It was Mary Magdalene who had to explain to him and the other male disciples what the hell Jesus was saying. So you know, this is where we all of a sudden we had this window open up on this incredible ancient tradition, which really was the mystical tradition of the Western world that was killed off by the Roman Church, and much to our great detriment. But I think the other notable thing is that those Gospels were discovered in the year 1945, the same year as what? The atomic bomb. Okay, Oppenheimer and the atomic bomb were the dark side of quantum physics. The light side of quantum physics were the Gnostic Gospels, because those Gnostic Gospels literally predicted every major theory of quantum physics, including the Big Bang, the God particle, parallel universes, Einstein's E equals MC squared, all in non-technical terms, but still, I clearly show in quantum spirituality how they had literally jumped the gun on quantum physics 2,000 and 3,000 years ago.
Wow. And you break that down in the quantum spirituality book, right?
In a very detailed way, yes.
Wow. That is a very deep and fantastic story. And it's almost like it's time to be rediscovered, or reawakened, rediscovered, came during a time where we were starting to accept, you know, there's just enough people that can grasp it. And it's interesting how you said females were the ones that were helping break down the information. And I was just having a conversation with someone saying that a lot of these understandings of quantum physics and unification of spirit, a lot of this is seen as more of a feminine energy understanding, right? It comes from it's got a lot of femininity. I'm having a hard time with the word, but it's very feminine, like earth energy connected.
Well, what it really is about is that, look, each one of us has the male and the female in us.
Yeah.
Carl Jung called it the anima and the animus, the male and the female and the female and the male. We also have the left brain and right brain, which I'm sure many people are familiar with. The left brain being more your rational, analytic mind, the right brain being more your intuitive mind. And the reason why the feminine principle and probably the earlier leaders of the church were more like females is because females are, generally speaking, more intuitive than males are, or at least they allow the intuitive side, the feeling, the heartfelt side of them to take precedence over the rational mind, whereas the males are more, you know, analytical, linear thinking, and rational, and so forth and so on. So I think that's what the feminine principle is about. And you know, look, Albert Einstein used the feminine principle. He intuited a lot of the answer to his questions, and then he worked out the proofs later on, rather than working in the more rational scientific way. I mean, he certainly used science. He was brilliant, but he intuited many of these things and worked his way backwards into proving them. And that's why, one of the reasons why he was such a great genius. It's very interesting, but to a large extent, the whole idea of awakening into consciousness is about merging our male and our female side. So Carl Jung said, when, you know, you merge the anima and the animus and in balance, you become sort of an actuated individual. You become a superior individual. Jesus said the exact same thing in the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas. He said, when you make the male into the female and the female into the male and the two become one, then you will move the mountains, you will achieve the kingdom of heaven, saying the exact same thing that Jung said a couple thousand years later. Mm. So it's all about balancing our intuitive and our rational side. And it's important, because I don't want to negate the rational side, because the example I always use is a rocket, okay? A rocket has two basic components, which is the fuel and the guidance system. So if the fuel is the intuition or the heartfelt understanding that there's something greater over there, so it's a desire to grow beyond the confines of the five senses. That's the fuel. That's the feminine intuitive side. So that's what gets you off the ground, the fuel that gets you off the ground. But once you're off the ground, if you don't have a guidance system, you're going to go around in circles. So the rational mind can come into play, because it can help you set intention, direction, and you know where to guide that propulsion, where to guide that fuel and that movement. On the other hand, if you don't have the fuel, you never get off the ground in the first place. You know, so you know, this is why both sides of the equation are very important.
Mm. And to that point, I do, and you tell me your thoughts, I do believe that it's very important for the guys to empower the directional side of themselves and be aware of the rocket fuel, and at the same time, the woman to be very aware of the rocket fuel, but then appreciate the guidance, and more of a unison of collaboration of men and women versus the confusion of being both or flipping. Do you know what I'm saying? Where, mm-hmm. Whether it be culture or it could be a whole bunch of things that could make you think or not sure what direction you want to go as an individual. I know we're going into a dicey area, but I just want to know what your thoughts are when there's people that are, let's say, confused, or they feel that they were born in the wrong body and they were supposed to be female when they were born male. I don't know if in your research and connecting the dots, if you've seen any of those books, those teachings, those stories address that, because it was said that it something like that could happen as well, especially during these times.
Well, look, in all honesty, I can't say that it's a field that I've studied, and I don't want to pretend, you know, that I know something that I don't know. What I will say is that the pitfalls, I think, are something that you alluded to, which is that, you know, you go overboard in one direction or another, where, you know, the idea is to appreciate, the idea is to really appreciate both. I think Jung and Jesus hit it in the head when it said, you know, you have to combine these. And I mean, look, in my mind, look, I'm a businessman, okay? I mean, I'm a hotel developer, an international hotel developer. All right, that's about as left-brained as you can get. But by the same token, I do these things, okay? So, yeah. You know, I use both sides. And in fact, I've used my intuition in my business all my life to envision things, to avoid pitfalls. I use that feminine side, that intuition, in my business life. But I also use my rational side, you know, in my spiritual pursuits, because, you know, I have direction. I don't get so out there and airy fairy that, you know, it becomes meaningless. And I think that can happen. You know, some people, I call it spiritual masturbation. I mean, they get to a point where, you know, they can render themselves kind of like useless. But so it's really all a question of just trying to achieve a balance, and that's the best place that we can be.
And achieving that balance, would you say meditation is a big part of helping you achieve that balance? And if not, or if yes, or whatever, what do you suggest?
Well, meditation, I think, is a great way, probably the best tool we have, to reach the other dimensions of consciousness that we've been speaking of, and hopefully a byproduct of that is that we start to use the old Greek adage, know thyself, and start to see where some of our strengths and some of our, you know, weaknesses are. One exercise I suggest to people, and this is where the rational or the intentional mind comes in, because there's kind of two forms of meditation. In the East, they tend to have more of a passive meditation. You know, transcendental meditation, for instance, that was so popular. In fact, my cousin wrote the early bestseller on transcendental meditation, but it was more of a passive kind of a thing. And that's great, too. I mean, you know, you can get things that will come to you, you know, in a passive state. I take more of sort of the Western approach of active meditation, which is to set an intention to problem solve things. And that's where, you know, the rational mind, I think, can be very helpful in terms of setting goals. But one of the exercises that a lot of people, I've told a lot of people, and they found very useful, is if you have a problem, you want to know something, go into your meditation and visualize. And incidentally, visualization and imagination are two of the 12 factors I cite in you know, really impactful meditation. Think of yourself sitting in a chair opposite the person that you might most respect in the world. It could be Albert Einstein, could be anybody that you think of that is very knowledgeable and informative. And just carry on a conversation with them. Ask them a question and hear what they say, and answer. And just have an internal dialogue. And if you just let yourself do this and don't say, oh, this is ridiculous, it's just me talking to me. Well, yeah, it probably is you talking to you. But remember, the real Albert Einstein was you too, you know, at a certain level. We're all one at a certain level. We're all tapping into a universal level of consciousness. You know, we express higher degrees of it depending on a number of factors. But so visualize yourself talking with somebody that you respect. So ask questions and carry on a dialogue about the thing that you're trying to solve, the thing that you're trying to overcome, the thing that you're trying to be. Help me out here. And you know, oftentimes you get very, very valuable information that way. And that's an exercise that I've turned a lot of people onto that they seems to have worked well for them.
I've done that, and it reminds me of that book, Think and Grow Rich, and Napoleon Hill cites that very exercise, which is very cool how you brought that up.
Oh, really? And, okay, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, I think
I'm glad somebody else is onto it.
Yeah, I think it was like one of my favorite chapters, like chapter 5, yeah, as a reference. Really cool. And to your point, yes, right, with the understanding or the concept even of us being the reincarnation of each other, so to speak, getting to that place where you can let go and just receive what you would imagine and visualize that person to say. So it's really intriguing, and I would actually be pretty curious if you were to sit down and imagine yourself talking to anybody more recently. Who, if you don't mind me yourself sharing, who would it be? Curious.
Well, you know, I talk to a lot of quantum physicists. I do talk to Einstein. I talk to Heisenberg, you know. And sometimes I will, you know, talk to certain spiritual figures of the past. It all really depends on what I'm, you know, trying to accomplish. But I try, like just like I do in the book, I try not to approach it from just one standpoint, from just one viewpoint. So the people that I might talk with in this exercise would really vary according to what I was trying to accomplish.
Yeah. Makes perfect sense. I knew you were going to bring up Einstein, though. I just wanted to see if you would say it. No, I'm just kidding. So we're getting to the end, and we covered a lot of ground. I was especially astounded by what you were talking about with the Gnostic Gospels, and that's definitely in the Quantum Spirituality book. So if anybody else is interested in hearing a little bit more about that, definitely recommend checking that out. There's a lot of things you're working on right now on the spiritual side. Feel free, Peter, what are you working on now that you feel that would be the most important for people to hear about? And how can anybody, like, what's the best way to connect with you?
Well, I would go to my website, petercanova.com. That's PETERCANOVA.com. And there's a wealth of information on there, videos, articles, descriptions of my body of work, the First Souls Trilogy and Quantum Spirituality. And it's a good kind of a primer for anybody that might be interested in, you know, pursuing these things more in depth. There really is a wealth of information there. The book Quantum Spirituality, my publisher had just entered it into one of about a dozen book contests, and the first results came back. They entered it into 4 different categories, and it swept the awards in 4 different categories. So if you go on to Amazon, it's sold on Amazon or all the best online booksellers or in some of the bookstores, you'll find it. Read the reviews. It's got like 90% 5-star and 4-star reviews, mostly 5-star. Nice. You know, check it out, because it really is a tour de force of creation, of how reality operates, of what reality is, and what it means to be a human being. It answers the deeper questions of existence that, you know, we all want to know. Where do we come from? Where are we heading? What's our purpose here? And I really think it's from the feedback that I've been getting from everybody, it's one of the most profound tools that they've run across to further their own spiritual journey. But remember, I'm just a signpost, okay? Your path is going to be different from mine. All I can do is kind of be the signpost along your journey by providing you this knowledge and information. It's up to you to take responsibility for your own spiritual growth and your own spiritual practice. But having said that, I think it's a really invaluable tool. And for those of you who are more, you know, like more kind of like exciting fictional bent rather than something that's more scholarly, check out the First Souls Trilogy. It's won 25 national and international book awards. It's about the first souls to incarnate in physical experience, and it traces their lives from the origins right up through modern times. And it's really mostly geopolitical and historical thriller. And you know, that's kind of it.
Awesome, man. I'm actually I got a question. Quantum spirituality, is that available in audio format?
It is. Pope Annalisa from the trilogy is available in audio format. Quantum spirituality is available in audio format. They're all available in Kindle also. And yeah, it's let me see, what else is something else? Yeah, it's available pretty much in all formats.
Well, thank you again for coming on the show. I had a blast, man.
Yeah, it was great. Good questions. Good to be with you. Thank you.